So the first piece I ever had written in a major magazine was in about 1995 or 1996. I had a piece published in the New York Times Magazine that was about the ongoing, at that time, collapse of honeybee colonies. And it was about, at that point, the main cause of collapse was either tracheal or burrow mites, I don't remember which. And the point of my very short piece was how this was inevitable. And what made it inevitable were the social, the economic conditions under which bees are kept. And I was particularly looking at every year, you get, I believe, 500,000 or 1 million or a lot of colonies down in just Modesto County, down in the Almond Territory, or Ammon, as they say. And they're there to pollinate. And then in the summer, they go all through the West. And you can get bees who winter in Modesto, and then in the summer, they're up in North Dakota. And you also have other bees who are in the summer in North Dakota, and then they winter down in Florida for the oranges. And so the point I was making is that when you pack bees in that tight, you're creating a perfect condition for a pandemic. And then when you combine that with mass transportation, you can move the disease from the West Coast to the East Coast within 12 calendar months. And we see how this applies to the larger pandemic, that what has been created are these extraordinary conditions that are just ripe for a pandemic. And until modern hygiene, cities were notorious for being population sinks. When people moved to London back 300-400 years ago, their average lifespan was about 18 months because of all the diseases. And in any case, so tight congregation and mass mobility have created conditions that are ripe for this. And then that is all horrific on every level. And then there's something else that's happened in the economic system that I think is, it's as a good friend of mine says, they set things up to fail. I mean, it's like they couldn't have created better conditions for the failure of the economic system. And what I want to talk about is something called just in time. And it was standard, you know, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, for a factory to have plenty of to keep like a month's worth of parts for whatever you're assembling on hand. And then you order and keep stuff about a month's supply ahead. But that switched over the past, really since computers, it switched. And instantaneous or very quick travel or very quick transportation, that switched to a process called just in time, which is where instead of keeping all that money tied up in the inventory or tied up in parts, you order parts the day that you need them, and then they are shipped immediately and they arrive. And this, from a Frederick Winslow Taylor efficiency perspective, this is a much more efficient way to do things. But this is going without a net. This is going without a safety net at all, and is in fact really, really stupid. And how this has played out in the current pandemic is that within, I think it was 2 or 3 days of Wuhan, or however you say it, going into lockdown, a Hyundai factory in Korea shut down because they couldn't get the parts they needed. And so there are, and we've seen this ramify all over as people have not had, as industries have not had, the inventory to keep going or the parts to keep going. And that's, it makes me think of, whenever the bears have twins, oftentimes the baby bears will have different personalities. And one baby bear might be really aggressive and the other one's really timid. And I spent a few years trying to understand this because, you know, the more aggressive bear would steal food from the timid bear. And how is this in a, the bear's survival, evolutionary survival? How is it in their best interest to have a timid bear, a temperamentally timid bear? And I learned the answer when one of those more aggressive bears was shot by one of the neighbors for going on the porch to get some food that the person had left out. And it suddenly came clear to me that there are circumstances in which it's in the bear's best interest to be more aggressive, and there are circumstances in which it's the best survival strategy to not take those risks, to be much more cautious. Plus, I've seen very aggressive, much more adventuresome bears. I've seen them, well, there have been times where they crawled up on the roof and would peek down through the skylight. And there are times when they would be crawling out on a branch. The branch gets too thin. I've literally seen bears hanging by a claw way, way up in the tree. And there are times if they fell, they would be dead. And the more timid bear is not going to do that. So what's the point? The point is that this culture has gone all in with no safety nets on industrialism and on pushing forward the economic system as fast as it can. All safety nets, all everything be damned. And that has given it a short-term competitive advantage over sustainable cultures everywhere. But it has flaws and weaknesses that are currently being revealed. And, you know, even from, you know, it's one of the things that horrifies me is how the left, I know I'm jumping around on subjects here, but how the left has accepted globalization as being a good thing and being a positive thing. And anybody who, nationalism has become equated with Nazism or with being reactionary. But in fact, I just, the other day, Naomi Klein talked about bioregionalism as being ecofascism. And it seems to me that it would be wise to have local production of necessities, that you can have a globalized system as long as you depend upon the globalized system and not on a local land base. But that's presuming that the globalized system will always be there. And what we know is that traditionally what has always been there is the local land base. That is there. You can feel it. You can roll around in it. And it's not controlled by distant entities who can act very stupidly. And it seems to me that if we were to learn lessons from this, which I don't think we will, one of the lessons would be to beware of the seductive attractiveness of global mobility and to remember that if something comes from far away, it can be interdicted by any number of means. And that this global transportation system is A, reliant upon everything going right at every step of the way, and B, of course, it's also reliant on destroying the earth. You know, I've said for a long time, and we put out videos about this, that if we sum up all my work, it's that this way of life can't last. And when it's over, I would prefer that more of the world still be here rather than less. And I've also said many, many times that, yes, salmon deserve to live for themselves, and they deserve, they're wonderful, beautiful, amazing creatures. But some of my environmentalism comes from just a fundamental conservatism, but I think it's a really stupid idea to wipe out salmon that you might need to eat in the future. And, you know, people are worried about where are they going to get, they're hoarding food, they're stocking food, they're worried about where the food may eventually come from. But there's a salmon-bearing stream about 30 yards that way. Or rather, it used to be a salmon-bearing stream. There's still a few in it, but at one time it was full of salmon. And I think it's unwise to destroy the earth and to place our reliance upon a global industrial system that will ultimately fail. So to try to sum up, this culture values its own form of efficiency, and just-in-time is very efficient in its own way. But that is a false god, and it's not the god at whose altar we should worship. What we should be looking for instead is resiliency. That's what nature is based on, is not efficiency, but instead resiliency. And resiliency comes from depending on what is local and nurturing what is local and working, spending one's life attempting to make what is local abundant so that you and those who come after can continue to participate in this abundance, as opposed to the efficient stealing of elsewhere abundance for your own use, that is, as we see, destroying the world and is inherently unstable.